I'm a firm believer in the fact that our expectations shape our satisfaction. The greater our expectations are and the farther reality is away from meeting that, the less satisfied we tend to be. I bring that up because there are a lot of visitors here this afternoon, and Charlie said, and the board says, talk. And some of you may have expectations about what a Lord's Supper talk is, and that being something around the range of 5 minutes or so. So let me help shape your expectations that I know what Charlie is doing in reminding me that I'm doing a talk. But in reality, this is going to be closer to a sermon on the topic of Jesus as we begin to think about the Lord's Supper. We're in a series here on the deity of Jesus, considering how the New Testament in particular speaks of Jesus in a variety of ways that indicate very clearly that He is God, that He is deity. And it is unmistakable. It's not something that in one passage of the New Testament you find one phrase that indicates that Jesus is God, but throughout the New Testament in a variety of ways where the text is trying to emphasize it or where it just happens to be so clear from what the text is talking about otherwise that Jesus is indeed God. We spent a few lessons talking about how Jesus shares the glory and praise and honors that God is due. And we've been working on a set of lessons here recently talking about Jesus sharing in the attributes of God or the traits of God. That as Paul says, the fullness of deity dwells in Him bodily. That He is the image of God. As the author of Hebrews adds, the radiance of God's glory, the exact imprint of His nature. And last time we talked about the pre-existence of Jesus, that He existed before the world began, but He didn't exist before humanity merely as an angel, but He is eternally pre-existent and divinely pre-existent. And as we wrap up this idea of Jesus sharing in the attributes of God, before we go on to talk about a third distinct category that emphasizes the deity of Jesus, what we'll do is talk about some of those things that are sort of quintessential attributes of God. That if I were to say, you know, tell me what God is like, define God to me, what are the attributes of God? These are the kinds of things that would almost immediately show up on your list. But as we get into this, let me start by talking about the paradox of the incarnation of Jesus. Because this is part of the difficulty of wrapping our minds around the deity of Jesus as it is tied up with His humanity as well. As Tom mentioned in the prayer, as we sang even in the first song, Meekness and Majesty, which I guess in itself could kind of be the theme song of this entire series of lessons, the majesty of Jesus as we think about Christ before the Lord's Supper. But as we think about the paradox of the incarnation, the deity and the humanity of Jesus, imagine, and again, this is what we believe, but just imagine philosophically at least, the infinite creator of the universe assumed finite human nature, grew from infancy to adulthood, shared in our normal human experiences, things like working and playing and waking and sleeping and eating and drinking and learning and growing and ultimately dying. What would you expect of that being? Would you expect to be able to completely understand everything about how He could experience humanity to the full and still be God? I mean, is your natural thought process of that, oh yeah, I'm sure I could get that pretty easily. Give me 5 minutes to think about it, and just like that, I've got complete understanding of this whole deity and humanity thing. Would you expect instead to meet paradoxes and mysteries all the way down the line? And that's what we're going to find as we look at these attributes of God. The Bible unhesitatingly asserts that Jesus has the attributes of God, yet the Bible also unhesitatingly acknowledges the paradox of the incarnation. So as we think about some of these attributes of God that are shared by Jesus, the first one I want to think about is the fact that God is uncreated, or you might say God is eternal. That He is the creator of everything else, that He is not a contingent being, which is to say He depends on nothing else. He is unique, He is uncreated, He is eternal. That's even the root of His name, I am who I am, speaks to that fact. And the Bible teaches that this is true of Jesus as well, yet at the same time, here's the paradox, the Bible teaches that Jesus was born. And we've got to wrap our minds around that as well as we can and grapple with this reality. But it is also clear that the teaching about Christ is that he is an uncreated being as well. I don't know of any passages that come right out and say, oh, by the way, Jesus is uncreated. But when you stop and think about what the Bible does say about Jesus and his relationship to the creation, the implications are clear. Creation came into existence through Christ. We've talked about these passages at some length already, so we won't belabor the point. But Colossians 1, in him, that is Jesus, in him all things in heaven and on earth were created, things visible and things visible. All things have been created through him and for him. And stop and think about the implication, not just that he's the creator generally speaking, but that everything that was created by him. As John says in the prologue of his gospel in John 1:3, all things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. Nothing came into existence except through Jesus. And Paul makes it clear in the Colossians passage that it's not just the physical realities that came into existence through Jesus, but it's the spiritual realities as well. Which is to say that if Jesus is without exception in the physical world or the spiritual world, without exception the creator of everything, and nothing came into existence except by him, what does that say about whether he was created or not? Again, it's clear. He cannot be created if everything that was created by him. That's what the Bible clearly is saying about Jesus, which leads us to a difficult passage, or at least superficially perhaps, a difficult passage, where in that same context, Paul says in Colossians 1 in verse 17 that Jesus was the firstborn of creation, or he is the firstborn of creation. And this is one of the passages that those who deny the deity of Jesus like to latch on to. And they'll say, aha, you see here, Jesus is the firstborn of creation, which is to say he was the first created being, and all other things were created by Jesus. In fact, the New World Translation, the Jehovah's Witness translation of the Bible, inserts the word other into that passage in Colossians, that all other things were created by Jesus. Of course, there's no textual basis for them inserting that word, but it does match very well with their theology. And in fact, you could look up, I could direct you to, if I check the reference again, I don't know it off the top of my head, but there's an explanation from the Jehovah's Witnesses of why they translate it that way, and basically what they come out and say is, well, it matches our theology. Not in so many words, but that's the essence of what they say, and it's clear that that's what they mean. Well, what does this mean that he's the firstborn of creation? Obviously, if it means that he was the first created being, then it would mean that he is not uncreated. But also, if that's what Paul meant, he'd be contradicting himself in the space of two verses. And Paul's not that unintelligent to make that sort of mistake. So what is going on? Well, the word firstborn can refer to the first in a sequence of events, but also it could refer simply to someone being the principal heir of something, or just a title of honor in general. And this is well attested in the Bible as well. Back in Exodus chapter 4 and verse 22, Israel is called God's firstborn. Well, does that mean that they're the first nation that ever came into existence? Well, no, of course not. Does it mean that they're the first nation with a God-fearing leader? Well, no. I mean, Salem had Melchizedek, who was their king and their high priest, who was a God-fearing leader. So there's nothing uniquely first about the nation of Israel. Instead, they are the heirs of God's promise. That's what they are. They carry this title of firstborn as a title of honor and as heirs of the promise of God. In Jeremiah 31 in verse 9, Ephraim is called God's firstborn. Ephraim wasn't even Joseph's firstborn, much less God's firstborn. And if it's just, every now and then Ephraim and the prophet stands for the northern kingdom, well, the northern kingdom wasn't God's firstborn either. As far as that goes, it's a title of honor is what it is in that text, not a reference to them being first in a sequence of events. Most telling of all, perhaps, is Psalm 89. a Davidic psalm, a psalm of the Davidic king that's rooted in the promises to David and clearly contains messianic language in it. And in Psalm 89 and verse 27, the Davidic king is said that he will be made the firstborn. Now notice that he is already in existence, he is already king, and he will be made the firstborn. So obviously in that context, in a messianic psalm of all things, firstborn does not carry that sequence of events. Instead, what it means is, again, a title of honor that indicates that Christ is the chief heir. Now, that makes sense in context as well, because back in Colossians chapter 1, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. Which is to say, he is the heir of all things. Or as the author of Hebrews says very clearly, he is the heir of all things. That's what this firstborn language means in Colossians. It's not saying that he is a created being. It makes sense between verses 15 and 16 of Colossians chapter 1. It's consistent with what the Bible teaches elsewhere, which the idea that Jesus is created is not consistent with what the Bible teaches elsewhere. So Jesus is uncreated as God is uncreated. Second, Jesus is unchanging. And again, the Bible makes this a clear trait of God as well. In James 1, James says of God, there is no variation or shadow due to change. God himself says in Malachi chapter 3, I, the Lord, do not change. Probably the clearest statement of God being an unchanging being is found in Psalm 102. If you want to flip over there, Psalm 102 verses 25 through 27. Psalm 102, verse 25, of old you laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the works of your hands. They will perish, but you will remain. They will all wear out like a garment. You will change them like a robe, and they will pass away, but you are the same, and your years have no end. And again, don't get this wrong when you think about this theologically. The point isn't that God is unresponsive to his creation or that he's unaffected by his creation. The point is that in his essential nature, in his character, in his purposes, he is unchanging and unchangeable. But again, you can immediately see the paradox as you think about this trait of God as applied to Jesus. Jesus is unchanging. Well, why does the Bible then say that he grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man? Why does it say that he learned obedience by the things that he suffered? Well, again, this is the paradox of the incarnation that we'll come back to in a later point. But as we think about this idea of Jesus being unchanging, the book of Hebrews makes this explicitly clear. Hebrews chapter 1, verses 10 through 12, what they do is they quote Psalm 102, the text that we just read. That passage from Psalm 102, the clearest statement of God being unchanging, is taken by the author of Hebrews and applied to Jesus directly. And then the author of Hebrews comes back to this idea at the end of his letter when he says in chapter 13 and verse 8, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. That from the past to the present and into the future eternal, Jesus does not change. He is unchanging even as God, as we are not unchanging. The creation is not unchanging. The universe is not unchanging, but God is unchanging and Jesus is unchanging with him. Now, as we think about the attributes of God, the three that we think about probably most frequently are that God is omnipotent, God is omniscient, and God is omnipresent. How do these apply to Jesus? Well, first, as we think about the omnipotence of God, we think about perhaps what Job says in Job 42, I know that you can do all things. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. And the point here isn't, again, to get into ridiculous philosophical arguments. Can God do that which is self-contradictory? Can God pick up a rock so big that even He can't lift it? Can God make a square circle? Well, that's ridiculous. And when the author of Hebrews, again, says that God cannot lie, his point isn't to say that God can't do everything, but He can't do those things that are either self-contradictory or opposed to His perfect character. So in that sense, you might say He can't do everything, but again, that's a ridiculous definition of everything as far as that goes. But what about Jesus? Again, we face the paradox. Jesus, the omnipotent, was tired and weary. Jesus, the omnipotent, slept because He needed to sleep. And ultimately, of course, He died. I mean, how can one who is all-powerful then die? Well, as we think about the teaching of Jesus being omnipotent, stop for a second and think about how absurd that would have sounded to the first century world. When Paul talks about the cross being a stumbling block, whether to the Jews or to the Greeks, it's because of this. We're walking around teaching this man is God and He died. How can He be God when He died? Well, as we think about the teaching of Jesus about this, think about it in terms of His death, first of all, since that's the big stumbling block to the omnipotence of Jesus. Notice what Jesus says about His own death in John chapter 10. No one takes my life from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. He says, I lay down my life in order to take it up again. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it up again. The point that Jesus makes here very clearly is that His death is not, in fact, contradictory to His omnipotence. Now, as to that omnipotence itself, I would direct you to Ephesians 1 or Colossians 2 or 1 Peter 3, all of which teach clearly that Christ reigns supreme over all powers and all authorities, whether in heaven or on earth. He reigns supreme. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 24 through 26, as Paul talks here about the resurrection and what that resurrection means and what is going to happen with humanity at the final resurrection, in fact, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 24, here Paul says, then comes the end. This is at the resurrection of mankind. Then comes the end when He delivers the kingdom to God the Father after destroying every rule and every authority and every power. For He must reign until He has put all His enemies under His feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death. He's going to reign supreme over everything, including destroying death itself. That one thing that might suggest He's not omnipotent. He says, I only die because I let it happen, and I'm ultimately going to destroy that too. Yeah, the Bible teaches pretty clearly that Christ is omnipotent. What about omnipresent? How can Jesus be omnipresent? How can He be everywhere? Well, the biblical teaching of God's omnipresence is not pantheism or anything like that, that God is everything or that God is in everything or that God is kind of diffused all over the place, that a little bit of Him is everywhere. That's not what the Bible is talking about, but that God is personally, immediately present at every location, simultaneously able to act as He chooses. Again, the Psalter is a great place to go to find this teaching expressed clearly. In Psalm 139 this time, Psalm 139 beginning in verse 7, where shall I go from your spirit, or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to the heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell on the uttermost parts of the sea, even there, your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. Wherever I go, you are there. In fact, Solomon says something very similar in his prayer at the dedication of the temple in 1 Kings chapter 8. Will God indeed dwell on the earth? Even heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you, much less the house that I have built. Or Jeremiah, can a man hide himself in secret places so that I cannot see him, declares the Lord. Do I not fill heaven and earth? Declares the Lord. God Himself claims this. Yet as we think about Jesus and the paradox, again, think about the incarnation where Jesus is in a physical body and obviously not everywhere at the same time. He's either in Jerusalem or He's in Nazareth. He's not in both. And it takes Him time to get from one to the other. Yet again, the omnipresence of Jesus is taught in the Bible. It's hinted at even in the miracles that Jesus performs, where a man comes to Jesus because his servant is deathly ill and he's a few days' journey away from him, and Jesus heals him like it's nothing. Or the Syrophoenician woman in Mark chapter 7 who comes to Jesus because her daughter has a demon, and the daughter's not on scene, yet Jesus heals the daughter even from a distance. Or you think of Jesus' encounter with Nathanael in John chapter 1, where he saw and he thoroughly knew Nathanael, even though he never personally met him. Nathanael is somewhere that he can't be seen, and yet Jesus sees him. And so these kinds of things hint at the omnipresence of Jesus. But think about what Jesus teaches about the time after he is gone. When he says in Matthew chapter 18, in the context of church discipline there, but he says, "Where two or three have gathered together in my name, I am there in their midst." Now, how can Jesus be simultaneously present with every different group of two or three people who are gathered in his name? Only if Jesus is omnipresent. Only if he can be everywhere at the same time. And an interesting thing that I just recently learned as I was preparing for this lesson is there's a text in the Mishnah, which is the writing of the rabbis, that say, you know, if two or three people are gathered together for just whatever reason, yeah, it's not that big of a deal. But if two sit together and are occupied in the words of the Torah, they have the presence of God among them. Isn't that an interesting thing that the Jews said when two are gathered in the name of God, so to speak, God is there. And Jesus takes this idea and applies it directly to himself. Or you think of Jesus at the Great Commission in Matthew chapter 28, where he sends his apostles off basically in countless different directions. Well, there's 11 of them, so it's not countless. But several different directions to carry his message all over the world, and says to every one of them, "I am with you always, even to the end of the world." Again, Jesus is presupposing his omnipresence here. In Ephesians chapter 4, the ascended and exalted Christ is described as filling all things. Which reminds us of that text back in Jeremiah chapter 23, where God says, "Do I not fill the heaven and the earth?" Jesus also fills all things, he says. And then there's the omniscience of God. God, who John says in 1 John 3, knows everything, including the minutiae of human life, like when birds die, or the number of hairs that you personally, individually have on your head. He knows what we will say before we say it, because he knows our hearts, Psalm 139 says. Or again in Solomon's temple dedication prayer in 1 Kings 8, "For you only know the hearts of all the children of mankind." And again, the paradox of the life of Jesus, he grew in wisdom. He learned obedience. He doesn't know the hour of his return. Yet again, the Bible teaches clearly that Jesus is omniscient. Jesus knows the hearts of man. Even as you only, Solomon says, of God, know the hearts of man, so also does Jesus. There are too many passages to cite. But how many times can you think of Jesus knowing what they were thinking in their hearts and responding without them ever talking about it during his life? Jesus claims to know how the people of Tyre and Sidon and Sodom would have reacted under different circumstances, which is a pretty strong claim to knowing everything. He says in John 5 that he will sit in judgment over all humanity. Now, there's a really important thing to think about. Jesus will judge all humankind. And that judgment, we are told in Ecclesiastes, will include every thought that we think. Now, how can Jesus judge like that unless he knows everything? As Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, that Jesus will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart. Or as John says more simply than that in Revelation chapter 2, quoting Jesus, "I am the one who searches the minds and the hearts." You think about the impossible sort of knowledge that Jesus had in his ministry, and it all points to this as well. Whether it's the knowledge of Nathanael, the knowledge of the life of the Samaritan woman, the knowledge of Lazarus being dead before he was told about it, or on down the line we can go. Jesus knows everything, and the Bible's clear about that. But this paradox brings us to one last thing as we think about the attributes of God, and that is that God is incomprehensible. There are things that we can indeed know about God, and there's a whole lot about God that we don't know. Because, as he says in Isaiah chapter 55, in that context about the great forgiveness of God, but certainly in principle about more than just that, my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so also are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. Or a few chapters earlier, to whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare him? Or as is said in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 20 of God, that he is able to do exceedingly abundantly beyond all that we are able to ask or think. There is truly a part of God that is incomprehensible. And as we think about Jesus and the paradoxes that we face, as we find teachings that clearly say that he is all of these things, and the incarnation which clearly make us think about those in a different way, it reminds us of the incomprehensibility of Jesus himself. Yes, the answer is pretty simple. The answer is, when he was in human form, there were things that were different than when he was just God. But even that's the incomprehensibility of it, isn't it? Well, what does that mean? How does that work? I have no idea. But that's clearly what the Bible is saying. Jesus is incomprehensible as God is as well. Think about what Paul says in Ephesians chapter 4 about Jesus. Ephesians chapter 3, verses 14 through 19. For this reason I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth is named, that according to the riches of his glory he may grant you to be strengthened with the power of his Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, and that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, to know the love of Christ, which surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. To know the love of Christ, which is to say there is something about it that we can know, that surpasses knowledge, which reminds us that Jesus is incomprehensible. And probably the greatest incomprehensibility of it all is the fact that this being who is God cared enough about me and cared enough about you to become human to die for us. And as we work through this series, we just keep coming back to this same thing. Jesus is undeniably God. And yet he had the humility and the spirit of service, because that is the essence of God, to die for us.